now at your service. Welcome to the St. Louis Composting Garden Hotline with Mike Miller on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
And we are at your service. Welcome to the weekend. I'm Stuart McMillan. Guest hosting today is Chuck Caverly, who's a botanist, certified arborist, and a Grow Native certified professional, director of business and industry development for Native Landscape Solutions Incorporated. 35 years of experience sitting just across the table from me right now.
It just flew by.
Then here it is. And the next 2 hours will also
fly by
as they normally do. Well, how are you, sir?
I'm great. I'm happy to be here this morning. It's fun to sit in for Mike again. So I'm looking forward to taking questions and seeing what people are worried or thinking about and how their yards are popping this spring. You know, we're past the initial flush. We're waiting for our last frost date, which is typically April 15th, naturally. And so
tax day.
So there's a lot of stuff happening here, and it's pretty exciting.
Yeah. So we've had the up and down weather, you know, coming in and out, and people have got to be thinking, okay, when should I put this out? When should I do that? And all of those things. Well, they can easily call and ask about these things. Sure. We know that number.
Yeah.
Here at KMOX, it's 314-436-7900, 314-436-7900. You can call in with your questions. We're answering those questions from beginner to lifelong gardener.
Absolutely.
We'll take them all.
Yeah, we're ready. It should be fun. It's, you know, the springtime is such optimistic time, right? We talked a couple of weeks ago about getting ready to split your hostas. If your hostas are popping like mine, they're up 4 to 6 inches. It's a great time to dig them up and split them. You know, crab apples, which are one of my all-time favorites, are in full bloom right now. They're fragrant. They're pretty.
I always thought it was interesting, something called crab apple.
Yeah.
Can have such a nice aroma and look cool.
Yeah, well, compared to a flowering pear, which is kind of pretty, but it stinks.
Yeah, you know, that's just terrible. That's the enemy of trees here in St. Louis.
Yeah, I've got some crabs at my house, and I noticed the other day I was standing there watching them, and there were six different pollinators, not just hummingbees, but six other species of native bees and beetles all over those flowers going to town.
So wow.
It's pretty cool.
Well, let's go to the phones. We go to Bob in Ladue. Bob, good morning. Are you there, Bob?
Yeah, hello.
You're on with us on the Garden Hotline. Good morning. What's your question for Chuck?
I heard you say something about hostas. It's still okay to split them?
Absolutely. Yeah, they're just poking their heads out of the ground. If you dig that big clump up, split that thing in half or in quarters, put a quarter back in, and now you've got three plants to move around your yard to expand your collection.
Okay, I appreciate it.
You bet.
Well, thanks for calling. That's a quick one. We got another call. Let's go to Art, who's here in St. Louis. Art, what do you got for us this morning with Chuck?
Yeah, inoculation of seed.
Say again?
Inoculation of seed.
Yes, what's your question about inoculation of seed? Typically, when you buy anything that, like a bean, any of the legumes, they usually will come with an inoculant on it. That's why a lot of times when you see that seed, it's kind of got a purple, dusty layer to it. But there's been some science that's been released here in the last 5 or 10 years that makes the case that plants actually inoculate their own seed in the process of producing it, which is pretty clever.
Can the expiration date on a seed be extended by re-inoculating? I'm thinking of a lot of scientific storage of these here generation past seeds in cold, very cold climates. But can the doggone seed be re-inoculated with fresh enzymes or fresh inoculants?
So if you pulled seed out of a bag or out of storage, it might be 10 or 15 or 100 years old, I would imagine you would probably want to re-inoculate it. But the inoculation, you know, when you're buying seed from a local seed house or, you know, a mail order, that seed is really intended. It's going to do the best for you. You're going to have your highest germination percentage for seed that's packaged for 2024 to put in the ground in 2024. After that, it begins to fall off pretty quickly.
Yeah, like I say, but I just see scientific co- companies pretty well know the extent of the coverage, the various different plants that are suitable for their enzymes or for their inoculant. In other words, can clover and other types of vegetative, like corn, can you go ahead and use inoculants? Don't they inoculate corn by going and pollinating from the actual florets themselves?
So there's a process within the plant called the rhizogy cycle, which the plant will actually translocate from the roots back up and coat the seeds with exoskeletons of microbiology, you know, the microorganisms within the soil. And so the plant really does its own self-inoculation, and that's part of the reason why local ecotypes or plants grown in local areas do best in local areas, because they're used to the biology of the soil. So most clover, for example, is a legume, and a lot of legumes do much better with a commercial inoculant. Thanks for calling this morning, Art.
All right. Well, thanks, Art. We're going to go to Sandy, who's calling in from Illinois. Sandy, what do you have for us this morning on the Garden Hotline? Are you there, Sandy?
Yes, I am.
Come on aboard.
I have a very amateur question. If you cut your grass when it's fairly long and it's still kind of damp from a rain, and you end up with clumps of grass everywhere around the lawn, is it okay to leave those there and just let them dry out and blow away? Or should they be raked up?
They can certainly be left. So, you know, and ideally we're going to mow no more than a third of the grass blade off at one time. But we've all been in that situation where, you know, we're going to plan to mow the yard on Saturday and it rains from Saturday till Wednesday. So now you're 10 or 15 or 20 days past what your ideal mow time would be. So in the springtime, we get those big clumps and they're super wet and they clog up the mower and they track on your shoes and everything else. So the way to do those is to allow that just to air dry. And then if you go out either with a blower or a hand rake, you can rake those after they dry and then just break them up so they're not smothering the rest of your grass. I would let it lay until it dries. Otherwise, you're going to spend an awful lot of time and get really goopy green trying to get those clumps out of your wet yard.
It looks pretty ugly with all those clumps there, and it's they're predicting rain for tomorrow, I think. Are they going to dry out that fast?
They probably won't dry out that fast. Remember, you're not going to really set your yard back unless you've got clumps every week for 6 or 8 weeks in a row. You know, so I would let them dry out, and then you could always mow them a second time, mow it a second time after it dries out, and that mower will help break them up and distribute them evenly across your yard.
Okay. Well, I said it was a very amateur question. I thank you very much. I love to listen to your show every Saturday.
Thank you, Sandy, for calling in. There's no amateur questions here. They're all good quality questions.
That was a great question because I was thinking the same thing. I was wondering about that myself. You're listening to the KMOX Garden Hotline, 314-436-7900, 314-436-7900. So when you're mowing in those situations and you've got, you know, a yard that's got a big hill and you don't want to mow it anymore, can you just throw like tons of wildflowers out there and just let it go? And
well, you could do tons of wildflowers. You could do almost anything, right? There's lots of options. There's a turf grass mix called Scottish Lynx that's out available in the marketplace. It's a real fine bladed fescue. It only goes 6 to 8 inches tall. Most of our weed ordinances in the municipalities are 12 inches or more. So you can mow that grass one time a season, and then it'll never get more than 6 or 8 inches. It gets long. They use a lot on golf course roughs, so you'd lose your ball in it all the time if you play like I do. So there's lots of options. The wildflowers, native flowers. You know, my rule of thumb after 35 years of doing this is if it's too shady to grow grass, it's perfect for perennials.
You're listening to the KMOX Garden Hotline. I'm Stuart McMillan. Chuck Caverly is here, guest hosting this morning. We're taking your phone calls right after the break on KMOX.
Real issues that impact your life. No polarizing politics, just relatable conversations. KMOX.
KMOX Garden Hotline continues live here on KMOX. Stuart McMillan with you. Guest hosting today is Chuck Caverly. He's a botanist. He knows everything. He's been around 35 years. Yes, he's shaking his head like, nah, I don't know everything. You do. You've answered these questions very well, very nice. Call in with your questions right now on the Garden Hotline, 314-436-7900. We do have a few calls right now. Let's jump over to the phones if I can get my computer to cooperate. Rob, you're first up. Back from the break.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I just have a quick question, and I think I know the answer to this, but on the side of my house, I have a small berm that has some shrubs in it, and I want to get rid of the berm, just level it out, and take the plants out, shrubs out, and kind of put them in other places around the house. Is it better to do it now or in the fall?
Well, some of that would depend on what type of shrubs that you have in there. But if they're still pushing out, so remember in the springtime when those buds swell and the leaves begin to come out, those buds are releasing a hormone called auxin, which stimulates new root growth. So for the lion's share of plant material, it's a great idea, especially the woody stuff, to transplant it early in the spring before those buds break, because as you put it in its new home, that hormone's stimulating new root growth in the new location. Right. So right now, if they're budding out, those roots are really actively growing. So I'd say if you can make that happen here in the next week or so, while those plants are still coming on, and that will give them a chance to reestablish before you get into the heat and the drought stress of the summertime, would be ideal. Otherwise, I would certainly wait until fall, and fall meaning, at or after they've dropped their leaves.
Yeah, I don't think they're budding out just yet, and I knew I had, like you said, like maybe a week or so to kind of decide if I want to do it now or wait till the fall. So, okay, very good. That was my question. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. You know, a lot of the native plants kind of seem to know exactly when to come out and aren't so threatened by our crazy weather pattern. And I noticed, you know, oaks are just now popping. You know, oaks are native. So the wisdom of that great big tree is something where, you know, we had saucer magnolias and calorie pears blooming 3 weeks ago. Are you kidding me? You know, it's just craziness. So, our native species are really the easy go-to because they're consistent. They can handle the drought. They know what's happening here, and they do really well.
They know the weather, don't they?
They know it.
Let's go to another caller. Sarah, you're on the line with Chuck Caverly right here on KMOX.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Sarah.
I have a question about an area in a space that I use for ground cover. I have Vinca minor in there, and several years ago, I thought because of a very hard freeze in the winter, it killed this section of growth. However, over the last few years, I tried to replant it, and nothing would seem to take. So I had the soil tested, and it came back that it was very high in potassium and phosphorus. How that section got that way, I have no idea. This is a fairly large area, and all the rest of the area seems to be doing fine, but this one section won't grow anything. So I've been doing a little research, and I came across some articles that said to use blood meal and copper sulfate to correct the high levels of potassium and phosphorus. And so I'm wondering what your thoughts are. I was hoping to replant it again, but I hate to do the work and spend the money if it's not going to work.
Sure. Great question. So Vinca minor periwinkle is a great ground cover. It's pretty consistent, although it's not native. The best thing about periwinkle is it does not climb, right? It doesn't climb up our trees. So it's really consistent. Chances are, so potassium and phosphorus are two of the three elements in most of our common fertilizers, and they tend to hang on in the soil a lot longer than nitrogen, which gets used up pretty quickly by the plant material. So those two items, as they hang into the soil, I'm not that familiar with using blood meal. My observation would be to work in some compost into that top layer to increase your amount of carbon in the soil, because the carbon is going to help change the pH and change the cation exchange capability of the soil. And I would work that into the top 2 to 3 inches, because that's where your periwinkle is going to live for most of its root mass.
Okay. I appreciate that. However, what I read online was that using compost is not a good corrective agency for the potassium and the phosphorus. And so because when I did this a couple, 3 years ago, I did add compost and it didn't seem to work.
So have you tried any other plants in that specific area? So my assumption is this is a shaded area, so it's beneath big trees.
It is. It's beneath oaks, actually.
It's beneath oaks. So, you know, periwinkle generally will grow just fine beneath oaks. I was going to say if you were growing up beneath walnuts will drop an acid. You know, they'll kind of create their own little herbicide to keep, and some plants are very intolerant of that. But with oaks, that's not necessarily the case. Have you had the pH tested? Did you look at the pH in your soil test as well?
Well, I just took soil samples and sent it to the Missouri Botanical, not Missouri Botanical Gardens, but in Jefferson City,
sure.
That service that they offer.
Yeah.
And it just came back that it was very high in potassium and phosphorus. And like I said, this bed that's underneath these three oak trees is about 70 feet wide and maybe 30 feet deep. And most of it is fine. But this section won't grow anything. And so that's when I decided to have the soil tested. And I had originally turned the soil over, added compost, and then planted, and everything died. I kept it watered. It just didn't work.
Sarah, you went back in with periwinkle again?
Yes, I did. And it was originally planted about 20 years ago with ivy.
Mm-hmm.
And the ivy over time died out. And so I replaced it with the vinca. And the vinca has done wonderfully.
Except
in this one section. It was there, except for a few years ago, when I assumed we had a very, very hard frost and it killed that section. So I just assumed it was the weather and tried to replant, and it just hasn't taken over the years. So I've just let it sit fallow for a couple of years, hoping the potassium and the phosphorus would dissipate a little bit. And I don't, once a year, typically I fertilize with 10-10-10 just in the spring. But I haven't done anything to this section for several years because I was afraid I was overdoing it in that section.
Yeah, well, it certainly doesn't need any 10-10-10 with your high phosphorus and potassium. Sarah, I think what I would recommend is maybe think of something different there. Get away from the periwinkle and maybe look at a couple of woody shrubs, small woody shrubs, some viburnums perhaps, that would handle the kind of dry ground, the shady location. They're going to have a little bit different requirement out of the soil and a little different expectation. And, you know, the old adage, if God gives you lemons, then make lemonade. Well, maybe God's telling you that particular spot isn't good for periwinkle, and you ought to be thinking of something else.
Okie doke. Well, thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you, Sarah.
All right, you're listening to the CamoX Garden Hotline.
Dive into all things Cardinals on Cardinals Conversations, your go-to location for exclusive content from CamoX. Catch it on the Odyssey app or your favorite podcast platform. Stay connected with your team. Cardinals Conversations, where the Redbird talk never stops.
Back on the CamoX Garden Hotline, Stuart McMillan here. We are live here in Studio B. Guest hosting today, Chuck Caverly. Chuck, we've got a lot of phone calls. Let's go right back to it. Nancy, who's been hanging on the longest. Nancy, thanks for calling.
Oh, thanks for taking my question. I have a question about boxwoods. My landscaping person who rounds my boxwoods hasn't been able to come out yet because the weather's backed him up. So I'm hoping he'll be here next week, but they expect rain and storms again. And he's never been here this late, and now all my boxwoods have new growth on them. So I'm worried now that the later he gets here, will it be okay for him to round the boxwoods without hurting them?
So the great green meatball boxwoods, right? So,
right.
You know, it's a plant that historically, through horticulture and landscape architecture, has been used to create all kinds of hedges and rows and structures. And that plant will respond to pruning almost any time of the year. The big thing to think about is you don't want to prune them too late in the season, and too late in the season meaning August or early September, because if we have an Indian summer or a mild fall, you know, that plant will push new growth and it won't have a chance to harden off before the frost comes. And so we'll get an early freeze, and then all that new growth will turn brown. And then so you'll be disappointed because you don't have that beautiful green shrub holding you through the wintertime. So at this point in time, you know, when he gets there, it will probably be okay. Remember, there's two times to prune a shrub, the time that's absolutely horticulturally correct and the time that you need to prune it, right? So if you've got a branch that's sticking in your front doorway and it's August, it may not be the ideal time to horticulturally prune it, but if you're tired of getting hit in the head, it's probably time to prune it.
Okay. Okay, so I can relax then, and even if he doesn't get out here in April, I'll still be all right?
You will still be all right. That plant is pretty tough. I'm not sure what cultivar you have, if it's Green Velvet or Wintergreen or Chicagoland, and there's quite a few of those cultivars that are in the marketplace. Some of them stay a little smaller than others. Some of them have a little bigger leaf or a darker green. Most of them are hybrids between the English boxwood and the Japanese boxwood. And those hybrids, those new cultivars are, you know, compared to what we would find at Mount Vernon or Williamsburg, really, really do very well in our climate.
Okay. Well, thanks so much. That makes me feel better then.
There you go. Rest assured, you'll be okay.
Okay. Thanks so much.
All right. That's Nancy in the 314. Let's go over to the 618. Jim has been hanging on. Jim, you're welcome to the program. Are you there, Jim?
Yeah, I am.
There he is.
Yep.
Good morning.
So, hi. I was trying to grow a ground cover, and I believe it's called Creeping Jenny. It's a small plant with a bright yellow leaf on it. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, that's Lismachia aurea. Just say that quick, you know, Lismachia. It's just it's a great name. Lismachia aurea, it's a golden pennywort or golden creeping jenny. I have it at my house. It's a great plant for containers because it'll spill, right, over the edge. It's also, at my house, it likes to creep into my yard, into my lawn area, which I don't really fight it too much. But it will do pretty good in dry shade, deep dry shade. And that bright gold color really adds a lot of pop to the landscape.
Well, I've tried to grow it for a couple years, and it grows great, and it really spreads quickly. But every year I get this, I don't know what it is, but it totally eats the leaf off the plant. You can see these little, I guess, I don't ever see them. They're bugs of some sort. And I spray it, but it seems like by the time I notice it, they've already kind of, you know, laced it out.
They've already gone, right. So, and that's normally like an August, September kind of thing, or is that a May, June kind of thing?
It's kind of like a May, June kind of a thing.
And does the plant respond, or does it kind of go dormant for the rest of the season?
Exactly. It goes kind of dormant.
Goes dormant for the rest of the season. So, yep. You know, one rule of thumb to remember, for every bad insect, there's 170 good species that are out there. And so if in fact it's an insect, I would suggest maybe you not spray it. And I wonder if it might be a rabbit that's doing the damage to those leaves Are you seeing them skeletized, or are you seeing little holes that get to be bigger holes and bigger holes?
Yeah, so it's just like when they do it, all you see is the stems and no leaves. And I've seen little bugs on them. I don't know if that's what's doing it.
Yeah, my guess is it's probably rabbits. It could be voles or shrews that are eating it because okay. You're not finding any leaves. You're just finding the stems. So that would be my guess. I have two dogs at my house. They seem to sleep from about 9:30 at night till about 5:30 in the morning. And the only time I see rabbits in my yard is from about 9:30 at night till 5:30 in the morning.
Yeah. Okay. Well, can you, I do have, a lot of different ground covers, ivy and, monkey grass and periwinkle. Sure. But I was trying to get something different for this area. Can you suggest anything that might be a good choice?
So
it's basically shady up until late afternoon.
So one of the ground covers I use a lot at my home is ajuga or bugleweed, and there's a couple of different cultivars out. In fact, they have a new one out that's gold. Very similar to the Lismachia. The other thing to think about from a native perspective might be sedges. You know, sedges are like grasses, but have edges, right? They have a triangular stem instead of a round one. They'll stay generally pretty short. There's an Evergold sedge that could bring that color into, you know, that same color into that dry shade. And that would give you a different texture than everything else that you already have.
Okay. Well, I will look those up and give it a try. And one last quick question. I also have some boxwoods that are in a round shape, and they're about 30 years old, and, you know, they look great. But unfortunately, I let them get a little bit too big. And, you know, the greenery, as you know, is just kind of only about a half or an inch maybe from the top down. So I thought about trying to trim them way back, you know, but then you kind of skeletonize them. Will that green growth come back if I cut them way back, or probably not?
So this is a great question, right? So this is about perspective. You put those boxwoods in 30 years ago. My guess is your car isn't 30 years old. Right. The mattress in your bed probably isn't 30 years old, and your carpet probably isn't 30 years old. So we have this weird expectation for plant material that we think it should last forever. So if we're planting a big, a white oak or a pin oak or a big tree, those expectations are fair. If you're planting tulips, your expectation should be that they're going to flower this year and you're going to have to start over. So that 30-year-old boxwood, if in your head you said, okay, I'm ready to replace this, or I'm willing to give it a shot. And so meaning to go back and structurally reduce it by a third and realizing that you're going to create this really cool looking kind of antlered deer horn, you know, antlered look, and then allow the plant to push out from there, because it will respond to that. But it might take you two or three seasons before it gets back to that green globe or that green mass that you fell in love with 30 years ago when they went in the ground. So the other way to do that is to dig them out and start over. Go back and get a different boxwood or try something different in that location.
Okay. All right. Well, I appreciate the information. Thank you.
You bet. Thanks for calling, Jim.
All right, KMOX Garden Hotline, we're going to take a break. Coming back from the break, we're going to go to Steve. So hang on, Steve. We'll come into you right after the break here on the KMOX Garden Hotline.
This is the St. Louis Composting Garden Hotline with Mike Miller on the voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Okay, well, as promised, we're back on the Garden Hotline. Chuck Caverly is here, guest hosting this morning. We go to Steve, who's been hanging on for a little while. Steve, what do you got for us this morning?
I have a zoysia lawn, and I was just wondering about some fertilizer and some insecticides and fungicides. Is it too early for the fertilizer?
So, you know, the general rule of thumb for zoysia is if you're working on it, you better be sweating, and sweating a lot. So, you know, on a day like today where it's going to be 60 degrees, unless you're wearing your winter parka, you're not going to be sweating. So I would wait to do anything to that zoysia lawn. It's a warm season grass, so our temperature's got to get up before it begins to really start growing, which is typically about mid-May. So I would wait until mid-May. Now, you could argue that for anything that you're going to do to that turf, I would wait for mid-May.
Okay.
It's going to grow, you know, hot and heavy all the way through August, maybe into early September, until those temperatures begin to change, the day length changes, and those nighttime temperatures will really begin to slow that grass down. And so just like we were talking about boxwoods earlier, about what time to prune them, one of the things to think about with those warm season grasses is you don't want to fertilize them too late into the year, because that new growth, if it doesn't get hardened off, even though you're mowing it, you can really set the plant back quite a bit. As far as dethatching or any of that work, I would recommend that you aerate that yard every year, because that zoysia is super thick with thatch, and that's the home for all of your fungal things. So real quickly, the rule of thumb for fungus is when your daytime and your nighttime temperatures combined equal 150 or greater, the environment is correct or is ideal for those turf fungus pathogens to become a problem.
Okay, what about like for the insecticide?
So again, you know, my mantra on insects is for every bad one, there's 170 good ones. So if you've got chinch bugs or sod web worms, there's natural predators that will go after those guys if you allow them to be there. If you're going to go in and apply a granular insecticide to that turf, you're not just killing your target, but you're killing everything that's trying to exist in that turf profile.
Okay. Last year I had them cricket moths, I think they're called.
Uh-huh.
Moth crickets or cricket moths.
Yep. Yeah. And so a lot of those guys, you can be really targeted when you do have to apply. And I would tell you, you know, if you apply judiciously and instead of treat the whole yard, treat that little isolated population. And so it may be just a 5x10 area that you've got them in. Then I would treat that and, you know, less is more is how I look at pesticides.
Okay. Okay. Well, you answered my question then.
All right, pal. Thanks for calling this morning.
Thank you. Bye.
All right. Let's go to Bob quickly. We just got a couple minutes left, Bob. Got a good question for us?
Yeah, and thank you very much for your show. My wife and I planted blueberries last year. We have two Nelsons, a Duke, and a Blu-ray. What can we do about amending that soil? We seem we are putting an ammonium sulfate in there, and it doesn't seem to be lowering to an acid level that blueberries like.
Right. So do you have any access to any pine mulch, like white pine mulch?
We have quite a few white pines on our property, and we've been gathering up the needles and putting them down there like that. We pack it in there, and I also use it for my smoker for my bees too. So yeah, we have access to plenty of pine needles.
Yeah, so I would grab not only the new stuff, but, you know, if you've got some big white pines, I've got some monster white pines in my yard, and they've got like 6 or 8 inches of that accumulated pine duff, you know, that pine layer beneath them. In fact, my perennial beds, I don't put any bark mulch in them because I just wait for the pine needles to fall. It's wonderful. So, but I would use those pine needles. They really, you know, changing the pH of the soil can be pretty difficult because, remember, to go from a 7.0 to a 6.9 is a 10-fold difference in the pH of the soil. So it takes a lot of effort to do that. And so by doing a little bit every time and every time it rains, those pine needles are going to help change the pH. The other thing you can do is outside of where those plants are, if they're, you know, 24 or 36 inches in height, I go 24 to 36 inches away from those stems. And aerate that ground and then work that pine mulch into that outer layer, you know, so as those trees or as those shrubs begin to push those roots out into that existing soil, they're finding more and more ideal pH in the soil in which they'll be happy.
Is there any fertilizer that is really good for, let's say, blueberries that can also help lower the pH in there?
The pH. Most of our fertilizers are pretty quick release. There is some little finer, you know, finer mixes that are out there that take a little bit of research to find them. You don't always find them in every hardware store. Hollytone is something that's out there that has, because hollies and azaleas like a lot of acid in their soil mix. So if you look at that breakdown, that might be a starting point for you. The other thing is they like a lot of water, right? So if you're keeping them watered, that's going to be successful, you know, especially in the drought steps, is going to really help you.
We have a very close access to a spigot, so we make sure that we do keep the water going. And we're watering with just pure well water, so it doesn't have anything that the city puts in.
Okay, well, that sounds good. Well, good luck with that, Bob.
All right, thank you very much, and thank you for your work with Grow Native, too. Oh,
you bet. Thank you.
KMOX Garden Hotline, Hour 1, done. Hour 2, we'll see you on the other side.
Now, at your service. Welcome to the St. Louis Composting Garden Hotline with Mike Miller on the voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
At your service here on the weekend. If you're just getting up, getting that coffee going, listening a little bit of what you need to do with your green thumb to make sure it stays green and doesn't go gangrene this year.
Exactly.
We have Chuck Caverly here. He's guest hosting this morning. He's a botanist, certified arborist, and a Grow Native certified professional, director of business and industry development for Native Landscape Solutions Incorporated. 35 years of experience in the green industry here in St. Louis, and we're taking your calls, 314-436-7900. And starting off this second hour of the program, we were talking during the break a little bit about expectations as a green thumb.
Right, exactly. You know, one of the questions was, you know, I've got a boxwood that's 30 years old, and can I prune it back, and what happens? And so, you know, there's a general mantra or a theme in the green industry, especially when you're planting new things. It's called sleep, creep, and leap, right? So we're
okay, run that by me again. Sleep, creep,
and leap. So the first year you put that plant in, it really doesn't matter if it's a little periwinkle or a lismachia or a big oak tree. The first year you put that plant in the ground, it's going to sleep. It's going to settle in and get adjusted to its new location. The second year, it's going to creep. The root mass, because like we talked earlier about the hormones releasing, being released to stimulate root growth, that second year, that plant really will get its roots established in its new home. And then the third year is when it leaps. The third year is when we get to see its classic growth rate. We see its classic flower, its classic fall color. And not that in year one and year two we won't see those things, but nothing like the reward that we get in the third year. So for us, you know, in the plant world, we're not point-click folks, right? It is an instant
gratification.
Yeah, Amazon isn't bringing you the solution in 24 hours, which would just kill my wife, right? Everything's Amazon at our house. And so because it's quick and easy. And but in our world, we're laid back. It's so much slower because we've got to allow that plant material to do its thing. Otherwise, we're not giving it, you know, the opportunity to succeed.
Speaking of success, let's get to the phone lines. We have Gloria on the line with us now here on KMOX Garden Hotline.
Yeah, I've called about these bare spots. I put compost in them, and I don't think I'm going to water them. And I put new grass seed in them a couple of times. I don't think I'm getting enough water on them. So I'll water them every day.
So these are bare spots in your lawn. So I would ask you, did before you put down your seed and your compost, did you kind of cultivate that soil a little bit with a potato fork or a, you know, some kind of cultivator?
Yeah.
So you always want to get that done. And then when you put your seed down, I would really recommend that you step on it, right? Compact that. Just touch it a little bit, because remember, it's the seed's got to get its moisture from the soil. And depending on what type of turf seed you're using, for example, bluegrass is going to be 10 to 14 days before it's going to germinate. So it's going to take a good week and a half. Fescues, the turf type fescues that are very popular right now, are going to be at least 14 days before they germinate. And assuming that you're in a spot where you're getting plenty of sun and your soil temperatures are up. And so you've really got to give them the opportunity to get to imbibe the moisture to break the seed coat to begin to germinate and begin to grow. So if you're watering, I would water every other day for about the first 2 weeks, and then you should be able to back off a little bit. It doesn't take a lot of water, but then I would back off and let the plant do its thing.
So how long should I keep it on?
I wouldn't keep it on. Since it's new seed, I wouldn't do any more than maybe 10 minutes. It's just a quick syringe of that area, and then I would move on from there. That's assuming you're doing a sprinkler. If you're out there with your hose, I would just saturate it till you see the water pool up, and then I'd go on to your next bare spot.
Okay. I got these, I call it wild grass, I guess. It's not regular grass. Do I have to dig those up?
So it kind of depends on what your wild grass is, right? And chances are, if it's like wild onions that look a little wanky right now because they're growing faster than everything else, you could spend a lot of time getting them out of your yard. But I think I would just ignore them, go into your regular mowing routine, and you know, by midsummer they'll be gone anyway.
Oh, okay. Now, put more seeds down, because last fall I put seeds down and ain't doing that. I put the seeds down in after September.
Right, and so if the seed that you put down last fall should be germinating already. So if you're not seeing any new growth, and you haven't put down a pre-emergent herbicide or a pre-emergent fertilizer, then you're okay to seed now. And I would seed now, and now's a good time. So thanks for calling, Gloria.
Yeah, let's move over to Beverly, who's been waiting a little bit, too. Good morning, Beverly. You're on the KMOX Garden Hotline.
Okay, thank you for taking my call. All right. Right now, I have a cool season lawn. The grass looks beautiful. It's perfect. Okay, then comes the warm weather, and in comes the brown spots and the fungus. And I've tried everything. What should I be doing to help alleviate that problem and keep my lawn looking good?
So your summertime is really, really tough for us here. Remember, I talked earlier in the first hour about the combination of 150 degrees. So if you're watching your nightly weather forecast and you're adding those numbers, those highs and those lows, and you're over 150, if you really wanted to, you could start in with a fungicide routine.
Yes. We'll do that.
So those fungicides are expensive. They're 4 to 5 times more expensive per square foot or per 1,000 square feet to apply or to have applied to your turf than your regular fertilizer is. And you're going to do it every 21 to 28 days, depending on the routine or the type of fungicide that you're going to use. So if you start in May, you may apply that fungicide 5 or 6 times. So all of a sudden you're making a house payment or two to keep to keep your turf looking green all summer long. So one of the things that I would recommend is this fall, in late August, early September, is if you have your yard core aerated and then overseeded, overseeded with a turf-type tall fescue. Turf-type tall fescues are more drought-tolerant, they're more disease-tolerant, and they'll perform much better in the higher humidity than any of the bluegrasses do. We get all excited about bluegrass, and just remember, the guys at the golf course, they have a full-time crew taking care of that turf. Every day, there's 10 or 20 guys out there running around fretting about what's happening with that turf. You don't have you're not growing, you know, greens. You don't have a greens mower out there. And so part of our expectation should be love it to death in the spring, love it to death in the summer, and then try to get it through the summer. Right?
So you're saying live with the fungus?
Well, I'm just telling you, there's a lot of expense to put that fungicide down.
I know. I've had professionals do it, and they charge you big bucks, and it didn't seem to make a difference.
Yeah, and you've got to alternate between fungicides, and it's just very, very difficult. So it's a value judgment to what you want in your yard.
Okay.
Thanks, Beverly.
All right. Thank you.
All right, we'll take more of your phone calls when we come back. We're going to Jack when we come back after the break on the KMOX Garden Hotline.
The exclusive home of Cardinals baseball, the voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
We're back on the KMOX Garden Hotline. I'm Stuart McMillan. Guest hosting today is Chuck Caverly, and we have Jack with us on the line. Jack, welcome to the Garden Hotline.
Good morning, gentlemen. A couple of weeks ago, you mentioned a special grass seed that sounded like something from Scotland or something like that. What was that, and is that type of seed good for overseeding a lawn?
So the name of the mix is called Jacklin, or it's made by Jacklin Seed. The name of the mix is Scottish Lynx. A friend of mine called me 2 weeks ago and reminded me that Jacklin Seed has been bought by another seed house, but the Scottish Lynx mix is still available, or it could be can be ordered from a quality. You're probably not going to find it at a box store, but you'll probably find it or be able to get it at a local garden center. So, yes, you could overseed it, and I would tell you we've tested it down at Tower Grove Park, and the guys down at Tower Grove Park are looking for something where they don't have to mow all 290 of their acres every week. But they, by the way that park was designed, it's all about big trees and lawn. So they've got to maintain it as lawn, and so the question is, how do you do that without having to mow it every week? So we've used the Scottish Lynx down there. I think they're up to about 6 acres of it now. They're doing it in-house, but with their own crews, and they mow it maybe twice a year, and it's a big time saver for them. So
What do you do? Do you thatch the yard beforehand?
No, I would just core aerate. You know, core aeration is in my mind the best thing that you can do for your lawn, because you're allowing better moisture penetration. You're allowing air to get down into the soil greater. Those cores, if you let them lay, will help melt and help burn down the thatch layer that you may have. So I would just do it at that point. The seeds will fall in either to the holes, or they'll get covered as those cores melt. So I would core aerate first and then apply that grass seed then afterwards.
And anything to do about violets, wild violets in a lawn?
Well, it's kind of like lemon and lemonades, right? So if you look at violets, violets bloom early spring, and so they're a great source for color and flower for the early native pollinators. But if you absolutely have to get them taken care of and get them out of your yard, what I would recommend is, if you don't have a service, I'm a big proponent of a 1 gallon pump up sprayer. You go to your local garden center and pick up, a selective broadleaf herbicide that you could mix. I would mix 1 gallon at a time, go out Saturday morning, spray that gallon, rinse the jug, rinse your sprayer, put it away, and next Saturday, try it again. And so instead of trying to treat your whole yard to make this monstrous event, I would just hit a gallon at a time, and then you're successful each week as you do that. Violets are tough to kill because they have a real heavy corm in the ground, a real heavy fleshy root structure that packs a lot of energy. Best time to treat those guys is September, when they're putting all their energy back into that corm for the wintertime.
All right, very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, you're listening to the KMOX Garden Hotline. We're taking your calls, 314-436-7900. We can take your calls right now, 314-436-7900. Let's go to Mary, who's been on hold for a little bit. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning. Could you tell me what is the best fertilizer for zoysia?
So, all of our turf grasses have a certain amount of nitrogen that they need throughout the course of the season, right? So for cool season grass, it may be 3.5 to 4 pounds, and you're going to spread that out over 5 or 6 applications is the best way to do that. So with the zoysia and Bermuda, which are our warm season grasses, your fertilizer time really is May, June, July, maybe August. But I would say May, June, and July. And so you're going to look for a good time-release fertilizer that's going to last 8 to 12 weeks. So you're going to pay a little more than what you would for just like a 10-10-10. And so whether that formulation is a 24-4-12 or a 35-10 or, whatever those formulations are, I would look for the higher quality time-release fertilizer nitrogen source. And then I would look to put about 3 pounds of nitrogen per 1,000 square feet, but you're going to spread that out over your entire summer, not just all in one application.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Let's move right along to Bob. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. Hey, I have several oak trees, and by several I mean there's at least 10 that started losing the bark. I suspect it's that fungus. Is there anything I can do to prevent losing these trees? They're probably 20 to 24 inches across on the stump.
Right, and so are they white oaks or red or black oaks?
I believe these are the ones that are losing the bark right now are all black oak.
Right. So that oak wilt disease is pretty serious. The best thing to do is kind of from a sanitary standpoint, so have a quality arborist come out and look at those trees. If you've got a lot of dead wood in those trees, you're going to want to get rid of that. And when I mean get rid of it, not only get it cut out of the tree appropriately, but also have it hauled off site. So you want to dispose of that material. If it's so much so that the tree is totally involved, you're probably not going to save them. That oak wilt really goes. But if you've got like one of those 10 trees that doesn't have any leaves on it and is just, you know, a mess, it's dead and it's full of disease, I would get that out of there as soon as you possibly can, because it's just becoming a vector. It's helping to spread it and making it available to, you know, for that variant or that vector to move to the other trees all the sooner.
Does it move by air or through the soil?
So it kind of depends on which one it is. It could move by insect. So it could move by any one of those three vectors, any one of those three mechanisms.
Yeah. I've got a lot of trees I'm going to lose.
Yeah. So all the reason to get it, you know, I would recommend reaching out to a good quality arborist to come out and take a look at what you've got going on and follow that prescriptive method. There's some pretty good information online through the Missouri Department of Conservation, as well as the Missouri Extension Service, that talks about oak wilt diseases. And I would recommend you take a look at that, and that would help you as well.
Yeah. I guess once they start dropping bark, there's not a whole lot you can do with them, is there?
If they're 24 inch on the stump, that's a big tree. It's an old tree. It's probably close to 100 years old, and so it's going to be a challenge.
Wow! Thank you very much.
Thank you. Sorry, I didn't have better news for you.
Thanks for calling, Bob. Well, you are listening to the KMOX Garden Hotline. We're going to take a break, and we are taking your calls, so call in, and we'll get you in on the back end of the break. 314-436-7900, 314-436-7900. KMOX is at your service.
Hi, I'm Cardinals pitcher Lance Lynn. It's game day.
It's the Cards and Marlins this afternoon. Ammon Total Access, 1220. First pitch, 1:15.
Let's play ball.
On your voice of the Cardinals, KMOX.
KMOX Garden Hotline is live on the radio. I'm Stuart McMillan. Guest hosting today is Chuck Caverly. He's a botanist, certified arborist, Grow Native certified professional, and he's with Native Landscape Solutions. Chuck, tell us a little bit, before we get to the slew of callers that we have, tell us a little bit about Native Landscape Solutions.
Yeah, thanks, Stuart. So Native Landscape Solutions started about 2012. We were responding, a landscape maintenance company was responding to this growing niche in the industry for native professionals. So the big thing, we do three basic areas of work. One is stormwater basins that all use native plants. We also do non-native invasive species work. So we'll go in and remove bush honeysuckle, winter creeper, autumn olives, all those kind of things. So we do that from anywhere from the Mark Twain Forest to a local homeowner's yard. And then the third component we do is prairie stewardship and prairie restoration work. So prairies, you know, think about your lawn and you think about rainfall. 75% of the rain that falls on your lawn runs off. If we had an acre prairie instead, that acre prairie can take 7 to 9 inches of rain in an hour before the water runs off. Hmm. So from a stormwater component, native plants are a huge success, and mostly because they have deep roots. Deep roots, meaning almost all of those species put their roots down 6 to 8 feet deep in the soil, and some as deep as 15 feet. And so those roots, as they die, create capillary bypasses for water to move and percolate into the soil. And those native plants sequester carbon, heavy metals, and help the water really percolate down into the soil.
And protect land and property and all kinds of things because it's holding all the water.
Yeah. You could argue we have a carbon problem. We have a carbon storage problem, right? Because we've lost so much of our native prairie. We've lost so much of our native plant material out and about. We've tended to till it all. And so if we go back to this, it really will help solve a lot of our problems.
Well, we need to come back to that topic on a later program. That would be interesting to kind of go in depth on that, too. All right, well, let's go back to the phones. We've got them buzzing like crazy. They're off the hook here. Let's go to Carla, who's been holding. Good morning, Carla. You're on the KMOX Garden Hotline.
Good morning. I have a question about the emerald ash borer. I have an oak tree about 50 inches around. It's a pin oak. And I think an emerald ash borer got under the bark of the tree last year, and I treated the perimeter with one of those granular things that say they take care of the emerald ash borer. The bark closed up in the wintertime, and it looked really good. But now with the sap coming up the tree, the sap is leaking out of that hole, and it looks like, I look on the Internet, and it looks like that hole that they make. Do you think that the tree can be saved, or is something I should take down? It's a beautiful tree, and it provides a lot of shade.
Right. So, emerald ash borers leave a really distinctive letter D, like a capital letter D-shaped hole. So it's straight on one side, and then it's kind of an arc to the, as it comes around. So,
that's correct.
So I'm not familiar with emerald ash borers being an issue on oak trees. Having said that, there are lots of borers that are out in the world, right, that love big oak trees. And if you have a big oak tree, chances are somewhere within that tree system, there are oaks. I was just reading, or there are borers working away. And I was just reading an article the other day that was talking about the resiliency of trees and the fact that that outer cambium layer where all the growth is taking place and the cells are becoming either wood cells, which are xylem cells, or bark cells, which are phloem cells, that cambium layer as it grows doesn't really have to be that broad in order to still supply and support the tree over the long haul. So, years ago when my folks lived in Creve Coeur, they had a giant silver maple in there right next to the house. And a giant, 60 inches on the stump. My dad decided it was too much risk. They took the silver maple down. And when they got to that big trunk, although it was 60 inches across, the active growing and woody part of the tree was only maybe 4 inches all the way around. And the inside of that tree, because it was a silver maple, it's a soft maple, was all really soft, spongy kind of wood chips, right? So it had no structural support to that tree. And so I guess what I would tell you is if your tree is showing good growth, good vigor, it can probably withstand, and it will try to compartmentalize, or it'll try to close off that impact by that little borer beneath the bark. And that's part of what that weeping process is that tree, as it begins to initiate new growth this year, it should begin to compartmentalize that infection, or not the infection, but that encroachment into the cambium layer.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, thank you very much. I didn't want to take that tree down.
Yeah, if you've got 75% of the canopy that's gone, then I would be very concerned. But if you're just seeing a hole, my guess is if you got a little higher in the tree, you would probably find some more holes. And those trees are pretty darn resilient.
Okay. All right. Thank you for your help.
Thank you.
Well, we go from Carla to Carol. Good morning, Carol. You're on KMOX Garden Hotline.
Good morning. I actually have two questions. The first one is that I have a hydrangea that basically over the winter that's just like the stem sticking out, but it's growing leaf at the base of it. and I wondered how I should care for that. Cut the branches down to where the leaves are growing, or?
Absolutely. So, you know, hydrangeas, several of the hydrangea varieties are marginally hardy here. So, you know, when we get to the minus 10, minus 11 that we experienced this year, a lot of that tip dieback took place. That happens a lot on other things like butterfly bush, the buddleia, or like crepe myrtles. They'll die back relatively low or all the way to the ground. So actually what I'm going to be doing at my house this afternoon is going to be cutting the dead stems off of my hydrangeas. And I've waited until the base begins to push so I know how far back to cut them. So okay. if you've got lateral buds that are pushing green, then I would take it back to just above the lateral bud, you know, on those old stems. But okay. if not, I would take it all the way to the ground.
Oh, okay. And my second question is, I have a Japanese maple that needs to be, I guess, shaped or trimmed, and I wondered when the best time was to do that.
So maples, you know, tend to move a lot of sap, and so they tend to weep almost all the time whenever you prune them. I would recommend that when you look at the tree and you decide what your goals are, is it height or shape, then I would try to reach your goal by, number one, understanding that I would never remove more than a third of the tree at a time. And I would tell you that if you limit yourself to, say, 5 cuts or 10 cuts with your pruning equipment and be happy with that, and then next year do another 5 or 10 cuts, instead of trying to shape the whole thing overnight, work slowly through the process. And so that might mean you take a little bit bigger branch off instead of the little bitty twigs out on the end. But if you take those bigger branches off, you know, something like the size of your finger maybe, you might find that your shape comes together much quicker with much less influence to the tree.
Oh, okay. Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for your help.
Thank you, Carol. Thanks for calling this morning.
We are on cruise control on the KMOX Garden Hotline. Let's go on to Mark, who's been waiting. Mark, good morning to you.
Good morning. I have a couple acres, or about 3 acres, that I live on. And on the periphery, there is a lot of the honeysuckle that's growing that I've been ignoring for the past 10, 15 years. And I'd like to know what I should do with that.
Yeah, so that bush honeysuckle, which is, for those of you playing the home version, is Lonicera mackeyi, for your genus and species. It's a species that was introduced into the state back in the 1970s. In fact, Julian Stermark, Dr. Stermark, when he published The First Flora of Missouri back in 1963, doesn't even show the plant existing in the state that far back. So it's kind of interesting. It's the perfect plant to be an insidious taker over. It leaves out early in the spring. It holds its leaves very late into the fall. It has a flower that isn't necessarily unattractive, but the red fruit is like crack cocaine if you're a cardinal or a migrating bird species, especially like a starling. They love them. So that honeysuckle, you can there's about 3 different methodologies that you could use to get rid of it. It depends on how aggressive that you want to be. You can cut and treat, and what I mean by that is cut the stems all the way back down at the ground, and then if you follow your non-selective herbicide, like a Roundup or a Garlon, something like that, if you read the label, it will give you a ratio for stump treatment. And so you could treat the stumps, and that will kill the plant. You could also go in and just do a basal spray, which means you're going to spray all the stems all the way around from the ground up to about 30 inches, and that herbicide will move through those cambium layers and get translocated into the plant. The other thing to do is just to wait until the fall time. So in your periphery, my guess is you probably have other species, some of which are desirable, some are not, in that wood line or fence line. If you wait until mid to late November, when all of our good native stuff has gone to sleep, and then you do a fuller application of a non-selective herbicide, then you can just spray the whole thing till your little heart is content, which gives you a lot of reward, and then they'll fail to push out in the springtime, and you'll burn them right down to the ground.
So that would be like Roundup or something like that?
That would be probably the most popular non-selective. Yeah, Roundup works great. The glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup, does very, very well on honeysuckle. We use it pretty much every day.
Okay.
But if I wanted to do something with it now, I should cut it off as low as I can and then apply that stuff on top of that.
Yeah, and the only reason I would say that is that way you're being real judicious with the use of the herbicide. If you try to broadcast spray it now and foliar treat it now, you're going to kill anything else that's in that fence line. You're going to run the risk of setting back.
But if I cut it down and then like paint the Roundup on where I cut it down, then that would probably kill it.
That would be great, because and once you make that cut, you want to treat it within 15 minutes, because that plant is going to suck all that right down into its root mass.
All right. Thanks for your help.
Thank you.
Burn it down to the ground.
Burn it down, baby. Take it out.
You're listening to the KMOX Garden Hotline. More of your phone calls coming up after this.
This is the St. Louis Composting Garden Hotline with Mike Miller on the voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
KMOX Garden Hotline. Guest hosting today is Chuck Caverly. Chuck, we were talking during the break a little bit about annuals. What's the update here?
Yeah, so, you know, it sounds probably counterintuitive for me to put a plug in for spring or summer annual flowers. But I would just share a quick story. My mother had polio when she was after she graduated from high school. And so my grandfather, who had a huge green thumb in Tulsa, where they grew up, in order to help my mom recover when she came back home, went around the yard and put pansies in the yard outside of every window. So as my mom was recovering, she could always go out and see the pansies flowering. So as she got older, my mom would go to the store every year and buy a flat of pansies. And so she would put four or five plants here and then move over 40 feet and put another four or five plants. And every year she would call me and say, come look at I got the pansies in. And I would say, Mom, you bought one plant for five areas. Why didn't you put five flats in and enjoy the show? So, you know, we talk about trees lasting for 100 years and giving you 100 years worth of love. Those pansies, all they want to do is give you love this year. So why would you just buy a six pack? You know, buy a whole flat of them and go to town. And they work great to fill in that one spot in your yard that's not doing very well. Put in an annual this year as you think and come up with a new plan for that spot in the future.
That's a good idea. We should try that. Let's go back to the phones. We have Sharon has been on hold for a little while. Sharon, good morning.
Good morning. I have a question about some flowers that were given to me. I was given a pot with several daffodils, a couple of tulips, and hyacinth bulbs in it, and they bloom beautifully. I want to know what to do with them now as they're dying off, to save them so I can plant them in fall.
Sure. So I would keep them watered, and then you'll begin to see the tips of the leaves begin to turn yellow. And I would water them all the way up until the point where that yellow is three quarters of the way back that leaf. So that plant is going to try to rebuild the energy that it spent in flowering. It's going to try to put that energy back into that bulb. Once they go yellow, I would stop watering them, let them dry down. And when I mean dry down to the point where you pull them out of the pot and the soil just falls apart in your hands. Clip off the dead leaves, store them in a dry place, maybe in a little bit of sawdust until fall. And then I'd put them back in the ground, you know, maybe late October. Remember, when you put those bulbs in the ground, the deeper you put them, the longer it takes for them to come up. So if you do 10 tulip bulbs and you put two in at, you know, or five of them at 2 inches below grade and five of them at 4 inches below grade, you're going to have a much longer bloom season as they work their way up through the cold soil in the springtime than if they were all at the same elevation.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Mm-hmm.
We go from Sharon to Larry. Larry, good morning. You're on the KMOX Garden Hotline.
Good morning. How are you? This is like a beautiful day out there, a little chilly.
Beautiful.
Quick question. I have a Japanese maple that's been in the ground probably more than 5 years. I would like to move it. Is there a chance, if I got a big enough root ball, that it would make it?
So is it an upright variety, or is it one of the kind of creeping weepers?
No, it's probably an upright variety. It's only about 4 foot tall at the most.
So if it's only 4 foot tall at the most, I would tell you, so your stem is maybe an inch and a half in diameter at the most,
yeah,
at the ground?
Yeah, it's not very big at all.
Yeah, but. So what I would do is I would see if you could pull a 24-inch root ball, in other words, go out from that trunk a good 12 inches and dig down into the soil and then dig away from the tree. Don't dig toward the tree, so you're going to create that root ball. Typically, you're going to want at least 9 inches for every caliper inch of root ball. You know, so 9 inches of root ball for every caliper inch. But because those, you're going to move it now, it's probably already pushed or it's already flowered. So we've lost that, you know, that opportunity for that new energy, those new hormones to be pushing new roots. So they're already pushing new roots. So you're going to want to go ahead and I would move it right away. Otherwise, you could just run your spade in around 3/4 of that tree and leave it in place. So you're going to do a little root pruning and then dig it in the fall time and move it in the fall. And so that plant will have automatically, you know, it will have created a thicker root mass by doing that root pruning.
Wow. Wait, if I do it within the next 2 weeks, is that soon enough or is that too late?
I would get on it. I would go out, you know, the sun's out today. It's a beautiful day. Yeah. I would move it today.
All right. Thank you, Larry, very, very much. And I'm really enjoying the show today.
Thank you, Larry.
All right. One last call before we go. Ann is on the line. Ann, what do you got for us?
Hi, my henbit. What do you do with henbit? I have a service. They came out and sprayed it. Some of it's getting yellow, but there's the regrowth.
Yeah.
And then zoysia. When is the best time to aerate zoysia?
The zoysia, real quickly, I would aerate when you're sweating. So I would wait until early May and come in and do it, or late August and aerate. On your henbit, henbit's one of those winter annuals. It actually germinates in late October, November, December, and it lays dormant, you know, just ready to pop as soon as.
And we are taking your calls, so call in and we'll get you in on the back end of the break. 314-436-7900, 314-436-7900, KMOX is at your service.
Hi, I'm Cardinals pitcher Lance Lynn. It's game day.
It's the Cards and Marlins this afternoon. Ammon Total Access, 1220. First pitch, 1:15.
Let's play ball.
On your voice of the Cardinals, KMOX.
KMOX Garden Hotline is live on the radio. I'm Stuart McMillan. Guest hosting today is Chuck Caverly. He's a botanist, certified arborist, Grow Native certified professional, and he's with Native Landscape Solutions. Chuck, tell us a little bit, before we get to the slew of callers that we have, tell us a little bit about Native Landscape Solutions.
Yeah, thanks, Stuart. So Native Landscape Solutions started about 2012. We were responding, a landscape maintenance company was responding to this growing niche in the industry for native professionals. So the big thing, we do three basic areas of work. One is stormwater basins that all use native plants. We also do non-native invasive species work. So we'll go in and remove bush honeysuckle, winter creeper, autumn olives, all those kind of things. So we do that from anywhere from the Mark Twain Forest to a local homeowner's yard. And then the third component we do is prairie stewardship and prairie restoration work. So prairies, you know, think about your lawn and you think about rainfall. 75% of the rain that falls on your lawn runs off. If we had an acre prairie instead, that acre prairie can take 7 to 9 inches of rain in an hour before the water runs off.
Hmm.
So from a stormwater component, native plants are a huge success, and mostly because they have deep roots. Deep roots meaning almost all of those species put their roots down 6 to 8 feet deep in the soil, and some as deep as 15 feet. And so those roots, as they die, create capillary bypasses for water to move and percolate into the soil. And those native plants sequester carbon, heavy metals, and help the water really percolate down into the soil.
And protect land and property and all kinds of things, because it's holding all the water.
Yeah.
You know, it's holding all the water. Yeah.
You could argue we have a carbon problem. We have a carbon storage problem, right? Because we've lost so much of our native prairie. We've lost so much of our native plant material out and about. We've tended to till it all. And so if we go back to this, it really will help help solve a lot of our problems.
Well, we need to come back to that topic on a later program. That would be interesting to kind of go in depth on that, too. All right, well, let's go back to the phones. We've got them buzzing like crazy. They're off the hook here. Let's go to Carla, who's been holding. Good morning, Carla. You're on the KMOX Garden Hotline.
Good morning. I have a question about the emerald ash borer. I have an oak tree about 50 inches around. It's a pin oak. And I think an emerald ash borer got under the bark of the tree last year. And I treated the perimeter with one of those granular things that say they take care of the emerald ash borer. The bark closed up in the wintertime, and it looked really good. But now with the sap coming up the tree, the sap is leaking out of that hole, and it looks like, you know, I look on the internet, and it looks like that hole that they make. Do you think that the tree can be saved, or is something I should take down? It's a beautiful tree, and it provides a lot of shade.
Right. So, you know, emerald ash borers leave a really distinctive letter D, like a capital letter D shaped hole. So it's straight on one side, and then it's kind of an arc to the, you know, as it comes around. So
that's correct.
So I'm not familiar with emerald ash borers being an issue on oak trees. Having said that, there are lots of borers that are out in the world, right, that love big oak trees. And if you have a big oak tree, chances are somewhere within that tree system, there are oaks. I was just reading, or there are borers working away. And I was just reading an article the other day that was talking about the resiliency of trees and the fact that that outer cambium layer where all the growth is taking place and the cells are becoming either wood cells, which are xylem cells, or bark cells, which are phloem cells, that cambium layer as it grows doesn't really have to be that broad in order to still supply and support the tree over the long haul. So, you know, years ago when my folks lived in Creve Coeur, they had a giant silver maple in there right next to the house. And a giant, I mean, 60 inches on the stump. My dad decided it was too much risk. They took the silver maple down. And when they got to that big trunk, although it was 60 inches across, the active growing and woody part of the tree was only maybe 4 inches all the way around. And the inside of that tree, because it was a silver maple, it's a soft maple, was all really soft, spongy kind of wood chips, right? So it had no structural support to that tree. And so I guess what I would tell you is if your tree is showing good growth, good vigor, it can probably withstand, and it will try to compartmentalize, or it'll try to close off that impact by that little borer beneath the bark. And that's part of what that weeping process is that tree, as it begins to initiate new growth this year, it should begin to compartmentalize that infection, or not the infection, but that encroachment into the cambium layer.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, thank you very much. I didn't want to take that tree down.
Yeah, if you've got 75% of the canopy that's gone, then I would be very concerned. But if you're just seeing a hole, my guess is if you got a little higher in the tree, you would probably find some more holes. And those trees are pretty darn resilient.
Okay. All right. Thank you for your help.
Thank you.
Well, we go from Carla to Carol. Good morning, Carol. You're on KMOX Garden Hotline.
Good morning. I actually have two questions. The first one is that I have a hydrangea that basically over the winter, that just like the stem sticking out, but is growing leaf at the base of it. And I wondered how I should care for that. Cut the branches down to where the leaves are growing, or?
Absolutely. So, you know, a hydrangea is, several of the hydrangea varieties are marginally hardy here. So, you know, when we get to the minus 10, minus 11 that we experienced this year, a lot of that tip dieback took place. That happens a lot on other things like butterfly bush, the buddleia, or like crepe myrtles. They'll die back relatively low or all the way to the ground. So actually what I'm going to be doing at my house this afternoon is going to be cutting the dead stems off of my hydrangeas. And I've waited until the base begins to push, so I know how far back to cut them. So okay. if you've got lateral buds that are pushing green, then I would take it back to just above the lateral bud, you know, on those old stems. But okay. if not, I would take it all the way to the ground.
Oh, okay. And my second question is, I have a Japanese maple that needs to be, I guess, shaped or trimmed. And I wondered when the best time was to do that.
So maples, you know, tend to move a lot of sap, and so they tend to weep almost all the time whenever you prune them. I would recommend that when you look at the tree and you decide what your goals are, is it height or shape, then I would try to reach your goal by, number one, understanding that I would never remove more than a third of the tree at a time. And I would tell you that if you limit yourself to, say, 5 cuts or 10 cuts with your pruning equipment and be happy with that, and then next year do another 5 or 10 cuts, instead of trying to shape the whole thing overnight, work slowly through the process. And so that might mean you take a little bit bigger branch off instead of the little bitty twigs out on the end. But if you take those bigger branches off, you know, something like the size of your finger maybe, you might find that your shape comes together much quicker with much less influence to the tree.
Oh, okay. Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for your help.
Thank you, Carol. Thanks for calling this morning.
We are on cruise control on the KMOX Garden Hotline. Let's go on to Mark, who's been waiting. Mark, good morning to you.
Good morning. I have a couple acres, or about 3 acres, that I live on. And on the periphery, there is a lot of the honeysuckle that's growing that I've been ignoring for the past 10, 15 years. And I'd like to know what I should do with that.
Yeah, so that bush honeysuckle, which is, for those of you playing the home version, is Lonicera mackeyi, for your genus and species. It's a species that was introduced into the state back in the 1970s. In fact, Julian Stermark, Dr. Stermark, when he published The First Flora of Missouri back in 1963, doesn't even show the plant existing in the state that far back. So it's kind of interesting. It's the perfect plant to be an insidious taker over. It leaves out early in the spring. It holds its leaves very late into the fall. It has a flower that isn't necessarily unattractive, but the red fruit is like crack cocaine if you're a cardinal or a migrating bird species, especially like a starling. They love them. So that honeysuckle, you can there's about 3 different methodologies that you could use to get rid of it. It depends on how aggressive that you want to be. You can cut and treat, and what I mean by that is cut the stems all the way back down at the ground, and then if you follow your non-selective herbicide, like a Roundup or a Garlon, something like that, if you read the label, it will give you a ratio for stump treatment. And so you could treat the stumps, and that will kill the plant. You could also go in and just do a basal spray, which means you're going to spray all the stems all the way around from the ground up to about 30 inches, and that herbicide will move through those cambium layers and get translocated into the plant. The other thing to do is just to wait until the fall time. So in your periphery, my guess is you probably have other species, some of which are desirable, some are not, in that wood line or fence line. If you wait until mid to late November, when all of our good native stuff has gone to sleep, and then you do a fuller application of a non-selective herbicide, then you can just spray the whole thing till your little heart is content, which gives you a lot of reward, and then they'll fail to push out in the springtime, and you'll burn them right down to the ground.
So that would be like Roundup or something like that?
That would be probably the most popular non-selective. Yeah, Roundup works great. The glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup, does very, very well on honeysuckle. We use it pretty much every day.
Okay, but if I wanted to do something with it now, I should cut it off as low as I can and then apply that stuff on top of that.
Yeah, and the only reason I would say that is that way you're being real judicious with the use of the herbicide. If you try to broadcast spray it now and fuller treat it now, you're going to kill anything else that's in that fence line. You're going to run the risk of setting back.
But if I cut it down and then like paint the Roundup on where I cut it down, then that would probably kill it.
That would be great, because once you make that cut, you want to treat it within 15 minutes, because that plant is going to suck all that right down into its root mass.
All right. Thanks, Phil.
Thank you.
Burn it down to the ground.
Burn it down, baby. Take it out.
You're listening to the KMOX Garden Hotline. More of your phone calls coming up after this.
This is the St. Louis Composting Garden Hotline with Mike Miller on the voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
KMOX Garden Hotline. Guest hosting today is Chuck Caverly. Chuck, we were talking during the break a little bit about annuals. What's the update here?
Yeah, so, you know, it sounds probably counterintuitive for me to put a plug in for spring or summer annual flowers. But I would just share a quick story. My mother had polio when she was after she graduated from high school. And so my grandfather, who had a huge green thumb in Tulsa, where they grew up, in order to help my mom recover when she came back home, went around the yard and put pansies in the yard outside of every window. So as my mom was recovering, she could always go out and see the pansies flowering. So as she got older, my mom would go to the store every year and buy a flat of pansies. And so she would put four or five plants here and then move over 40 feet and put another four or five plants. And every year she would call me and say, come look at, I got the pansies in. And I would say, Mom, you bought one plant for five areas. Why didn't you put five flats in and enjoy the show? So, you know, we talk about trees lasting for 100 years and giving you 100 years worth of love. Those pansies, all they want to do is give you love this year. So why would you just buy a six pack? You know, buy a whole flat of them and go to town. And they work great to fill in that one spot in your yard that's not doing very well. Put in an annual this year as you think and come up with a new plan for that spot in the future.
That's a good idea. We should try that. Let's go back to the phones. We have Sharon has been on hold for a little while. Sharon, good morning.
Good morning. I have a question about some flowers that were given to me. I was given a pot with several daffodils, a couple of tulips, and hyacinth bulbs in it, and they bloom beautifully. I want to know what to do with them now as they're dying off, to save them so I can plant them in fall.
Sure. So I would keep them watered, and then you'll begin to see the tips of the leaves begin to turn yellow. And I would water them all the way up until the point where that yellow is three quarters of the way back that leaf. So that plant is going to try to rebuild the energy that it spent in flowering. It's going to try to put that energy back into that bulb. Once they go yellow, I would stop watering them, let them dry down. And when I mean dry down to the point where you pull them out of the pot and the soil just falls apart in your hands. Clip off the dead leaves, store them in a dry place, maybe in a little bit of sawdust until fall, and then I'd put them back in the ground, you know, maybe late October. Remember, when you put those bulbs in the ground, the deeper you put them, the longer it takes for them to come up. So if you do 10 tulip bulbs and you put two in at, you know, or five of them at 2 inches below grade and five of them at 4 inches below grade, you're going to have a much longer bloom season as they work their way up through the cold soil in the springtime than if they were all at the same elevation.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Mm-hmm.
We go from Sharon to Larry. Larry, good morning. You're on the KMOX Garden Hotline.
Good morning. How are you? This is like a beautiful day out there, a little chilly.
Beautiful.
Quick question. I have a Japanese maple that's been in the ground probably more than 5 years. I would like to move it. Is there a chance, if I got a big enough root ball, that it would make it?
So is it an upright variety, or is it one of the kind of creeping weepers?
No, it's probably an upright variety. It's only about 4 foot tall at the most.
So if it's only 4 foot tall at the most, I would tell you, so your stem is maybe an inch and a half in diameter at the most at the ground?
Yeah, it's not very big at all.
Yeah, but. So what I would do is I would see if you could pull a 24-inch root ball. In other words, go out from that trunk a good 12 inches and dig down into the soil and then dig away from the tree. Don't dig toward the tree. So you're going to create that root ball. Typically, you're going to want at least 9 inches for every caliper inch of root ball. You know, so 9 inches of root ball for every caliper inch. But because you're going to move it now, it's probably already pushed or it's already flowered. So we've lost that, you know, that opportunity for that new energy, those new hormones to be pushing new roots. So they're already pushing new roots. So you're going to want to go ahead and I would move it right away Otherwise, you could just run your spade in around three quarters of that tree and leave it in place. So you're going to do a little root pruning and then dig it in the fall time and move it in the fall. And so that plant will have automatically, you know, has, it will have created a thicker root mass by doing that root pruning.
Wow. If I do it within the next 2 weeks, is that soon enough or is that too late?
I would get on it. I would go out, you know, the sun's out today. It's a beautiful day. Yeah. I would move it today.
All right. All right. Thanks, thank you, Larry, very, very much. And I'm really enjoying the show today.
Thank you, Larry.
All right. One last call before we go. Ann is on the line. Ann, what do you got for us?
Hi. My henbit. What do you do with henbit? I have it. A service that came out and sprayed it. Some of it's getting yellow, but there's the regrowth.
Yeah.
And then zoysia, when was the best time to aerate zoysia?
The zoysia, real quickly, I would aerate when you're sweating. So I would wait until early May and come in and do it, or late August and aerate. On your henbit, henbit's one of those winter annuals. It actually germinates in late October, November, December, and it lays dormant, you know, just ready to pop as soon as the sun comes on in the springtime, and it's flowering now. Henbit and chickweed are two of my favorite things back from the lawn application days, because I could always get great control, because normally by the time I came out and sprayed it, they were already on their way out. So they're going to disappear here in another couple of weeks anyway. So your lawn care applicator who said, I've got it treated, yeah, he's got it treated, but it's already on its way out. So the time to look for that is in the fall time, not necessarily in the spring.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thanks for calling in this morning, Ann.
Well, that's going to do it this morning for the KMOX Garden Hotline. Chuck Caverly. Thanks so much, Chuck.
Thanks, Stuart. Enjoy the morning.